Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's said that the U.S. Senate is the world's greatest deliberative body. That's often attributed to President James Buchanan, but it's been repeated often since. Most recently as a reminder to House impeachment managers to be on their best behavior at the last Trump impeachment trial by Chief Justice John Roberts. But the truth is, there's very little debate and deliberation in today's U.S. Senate. My guest says one major reason is the kill switch, the filibuster. That means a supermajority is needed for most action and consideration in the Senate. Well, my guest, Adam Gentleson, observed this close up as a staffer in the majority and minority as Deputy Chief of Staff for former Senator Harry Reid, who served as both Majority Leader and Minority Leader. Reid invoked the nuclear option during his reign, eliminating the filibuster for nominations and appointments, but Gentleson says more reforms are needed to get the Senate working again. He recounts the history of the filibuster in his new book, Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Chief among his recommendations is doing away or reforming the filibuster. His book reminds us the filibuster was not a product of our founding fathers, but of slave state senators wanting to protect that odious institution in the middle of the 19th century. Adam Gentleson joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Adam Gentleson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we talk about your new book, Kill Switch, I would like to get your reaction to last week's assault on Congress and how Congress has responded.
Yeah, watching it was just one of the scariest, most depressing things I've ever witnessed. It really hit home for me personally. Some of the scenes that have been televised widely were right outside the offices where I used to work. These were free and open spaces where staff and reporters and senators and congressmen and women mingled freely, and seeing them taken over and seeing the Capitol ransacked in this way was just truly shocking. I think in terms of how Congress is responding, there are some signs that they will deliver the accountability that's needed. I think the most important thing here is there have to be consequences for the people who did this and for the lawmakers who enabled them. There has to be a clear demonstration that what we've seen falls outside the bounds of acceptable behavior, including from the lawmakers themselves, and that needs to be a hard line that's drawn by members of Congress of both parties to make sure that this sort of thing never happens again.
I know there's will be certainly an investigation of the Capitol Police. Do you think there will be an investigation of people inside the building? Because there was some signs that the mob knew exactly where to go. You know, certain representatives like Representative Clyburn said, you know, look, my space, the parliamentarian's office, is not really easy to find. And yet they knew where to go.
That's right. I think, you know, incoming new Congressman Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina said to the mob that they should lightly threaten members. And look, the Capitol is an incredibly complex maze of hallways and what they call hideaways and offices. They're not clearly labeled. And a lot of folks seem to have a very clear idea of where they were going. I mean, there's a reason that you have guided tours of this place, because it's very easy to get lost and very hard to find your way around it. I think it's really disturbing. You saw some clear images of heroism from the Capitol Police, such as the officer who drew protesters away from the Senate floor and may have very well saved the lives of some senators who were on the floor and gave them just enough time for them to be evacuated. But on the other hand, you saw what seems to be some dereliction of duty. Officers opening barricades, waving protesters through, and there have been reports of them giving directions to protesters and helping them find their way around. So I hope there will be an investigation. I'm sure there will be, and I hope that it is a thorough one that is eyes wide open about some of the problems that seem to exist within the organization.
Now, as we speak today, the House is considering impeachment. Do you believe it is feasible at this point within President Trump's term?
Impeachment, definitely, in the House. The question of removal in the Senate hinges on a bunch of procedural factors. In order to come back into session, the Senate is currently adjourned until the 19th, the day before the inauguration. So to come back into session before then will require cooperation from Republicans, or at least the cooperation of Senator Mitch McConnell. So it is feasible. To do it will require bipartisan cooperation. The question of whether there will be enough Republican senators to vote to remove Trump from office in the Senate once he's impeached in the House, I think, is very much an open question. I hope there is, I think that is a necessary step here. It will cause a lot of pain in the Republican Party to purge Trump in this way, but I think that's a necessary reckoning that this party has to have right now.
Right now, we're not hearing from Senator McConnell, but he's quoted as saying he welcomes impeachment as a way to end Trump's influence on the GOP, on his party, and so he can rebuild his party. You know, it's hard to say what he will actually do, but do you think that if he is in favor of impeachment, of conviction, that there will be enough Republicans to go along to actually convict the president, whether he's the president or the ex-president?
I think that McConnell can get the votes for removal if he chooses to do so. I think that is a steep climb. The reports, you know, were sourced to background and have not yet been confirmed by his office, although there are all indications that his office is not trying to knock them down either. So I think they're an accurate reflection of his current thinking, but they do stop short of saying that he will mount an effort to remove the president in the Senate. I think that at the end of the day, Mitch McConnell will always do what he thinks is best for his own political interests and for the interests of Republicans. And that's not meant as a value judgment. That's partially the job of the Senate leader. And I think that if he thinks that the long-term political interests of Senate Republicans are best served by purging Trump from the party, then I think that's what he will do.
You've served.
But I'm not sure. I just want to add that I'm not sure that he's made that judgment yet. I think it's a tough call because that is tantamount to sort of starting a civil war within the party, a civil political war within the party. And that's a big and tough call to make.
Now, you've served as Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid when he was minority leader and majority leader. You know how that works. I mean, do you get the sense that he is open to impeachment just based on what these press reports are and that the fact that the office is not tamping down expectations or discounting those reports?
I suspect that he is still very much trying to make up his mind. I think he is open to it. I'm sure that that is accurate. I trust the reporting on that. I think, you know, the question of whether he will actually follow through with it is still an open one. You could also, you know, read these reports as a way to try to make sure that Trump is on his best behavior. They came after Trump released that video or on camera, you know, seeming to continue to encourage violence. So maybe this is sort of a high fastball meant to keep Trump on his best behavior through inauguration in the hopes that Republicans will not have to actually remove him. But it does seem like a very live possibility that if Trump continues to misbehave or if McConnell decides that it's in Senate Republicans' interest, that they will follow through and remove him from office.
Now, the Senate is going to be 50-50 in the upcoming session, this coming session. What is it like to work in a Senate that is evenly split?
It's very difficult. We haven't seen an evenly split Senate since the very beginning of this century. In that case, the leaders at the time, Senator Daschle and Senator Trent Lott, negotiated a power-sharing agreement where they compromised on things like control of committees and who would decide the floor agenda. In this case, I think we're unlikely to see any sort of power-sharing agreement, but it does mean that every single vote is going to be narrowly decided. You know, committee control doesn't hinge on the size of your majority. If you have a majority, you get control of the committees, period. So, you know, things like confirming nominations should be easier. Things like bringing President Biden's agenda to the floor for a vote in the first place should be easier. But it just means that everything has to be closely negotiated. And it also means one of the political dynamics that we've seen emerge in recent years is that the party out of power knows that it is just one or two seats away from reclaiming the majority. And what that does is sort of provide a perverse incentive. You know, intuitively, you might think that a closely divided Senate is good for bipartisanship because the parties are so evenly matched in their the amount of seats that they control. But what we've seen, and this has been well documented for decades by political scientists, is that these narrow majorities actually create an enormous incentive for the party that is in the minority to block the party that's in the majority. Because doing so makes the party in the majority look bad. It creates a sense of gridlock among voters. And then the party in the minority rides that discontent in the next elections to take back the majority. So having the majority be within reach for the party that's out of power does create these perverse incentives to actually try to oppose the party that's in power.
That means every vote will probably hinge on the vice president being in the chair then as well, too?
Well, they could in a lot of cases. That's right. I mean, certainly for confirmations, which after Senator Reid reformed the rules of 2013, the threshold for most nominees has been lowered from the supermajority, where you see it for legislation oftentimes, down to a simple majority. So, you know, all of Biden's cabinet nominees will pass or fail on a simple majority vote. And it's quite likely that the vice president will be the tie-breaking vote in all of those cases. For other legislation, you still need to get to 60 votes to pass most things. And that will be a very difficult process for President Biden.
Now, what I've understood is that as the Republicans use reconciliation during the first 2 years of President Trump's term, the Democrats will also use reconciliation, of budget enhanced items so that they can get a lot done through reconciliation. Can you describe that for us, how that will work?
Yeah, sure. So reconciliation is an end run around the filibuster, basically. It was a special track that was created in the 70s to allow budgets to pass through Congress in an expedited fashion. You have to adhere to a very complicated set of rules to use this track, and it primarily applies to things that have, or exclusively applies to things that have budgetary impacts. So things like democracy reforms, statehood, civil rights legislation that Democrats are contemplating are excluded from this track. However, many economic priorities can be moved along this track. You have to pass what's called a bird pass, which is a procedural test that was created by former Majority Leader Robert Byrd. And the parliamentarian basically dunks every single piece of legislative business into this bird bath to see if it passes the rules. It's a tough test. It's quite likely that some major pieces of Biden's agenda will not survive the bird bath. But those that do will come to the floor for a majority vote. You have to endure what's called voterama in Senate parlance, which is an endless series of amendment votes. I've sat through a number of those in my time. Often you'll stay up all night having vote after vote after vote, up into the hundreds. But once you go through all of this this complicated path, what you have is a legislative package that can be brought to the floor and passed or failed on a simple majority. So I think Biden is likely to use this procedure early on. He will be able to pass a significant chunk of his agenda through this path as long as it passes all the necessary procedural tests. But if it runs afoul of the procedure, then you sort of find yourself back at square one where you have to decide whether to initiate essentially the nuclear option on the reconciliation rules themselves. So it is a possible path, but it's complicated and could end up resulting in the same kind of rules reform that you might have to pursue through the normal path.
My guest today is Adam Gentleson. He's a former deputy chief of staff to a former Senator Harry Reid, who was Senate majority and minority leader. He's currently the public affairs director of Democracy Forward and the author of Kill Switch, a new book, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. It's published by Live Right. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. So let's switch to the kill switch, and I assume that you're referring to the filibuster. Tell us about the kill switch.
Yeah, so the filibuster is probably the one thing that people associate the most with the Senate. They often think of Jimmy Stewart, I think, in the public imagination, standing on the Senate floor in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, holding an extended speech and trying to block a piece of legislation that he opposed. And even though the filibuster is sort of the number one thing that people know about the Senate, the irony of that is that it wasn't part of the original Senate and, in fact, was not part of the framers' vision for the Senate. The filibuster was created long after the framers all passed away, and it was created for the primary purpose of protecting slavery. The main innovator of the filibuster was John C. Calhoun, known as the Great Nullifier for his role in the nullification crisis, and a grandfather of the Confederacy. The reason Calhoun invented the filibuster was that he saw that the march of progress was going to likely eliminate slavery. And he needed a stronger way to protect the interests of an outnumbered minority in the Senate. Part of Calhoun's innovation was marrying this obstructionist technique to the principle of minority rights. And he tried to claim sort of the imprimatur of framers like James Madison, who had written extensively about the need for protecting minority factions within the United States government. The problem was that even in Madison's writings, he always stopped well short of where Calhoun wanted to go. Madison wrote extensively about the need to protect minority factions. But in those same writings, including Federalist No. 10, which is one of his most quoted tracts on the need for protection of minority factions, even in Federalist Number 10, Madison made very clear that what he intended was for the minority to have a platform to make their case and the right to have input in the legislative process. But at the end of the day, after they had had the ability to make their case, a vote in the Senate should proceed to a simple majority vote. Madison did not believe that the minority should be able to stop a bill altogether if they didn't agree with it, and he definitely did not believe that they should be able to force that bill to clear a supermajority threshold, which is what we have in the Senate today.
Now, as I understand it, the filibuster, even after it was created, it was still a seldom used device, and it really was a matter, for the most part, of senators holding the floor to basically convince the majority to drop their plans.
That's absolutely right. For about 150 years, from when Calhoun sort of brought the filibuster into existence in the mid-19th century, up until the late 19th century, the filibuster was relatively rarely used, and I'm talking maybe once or twice per two-year session of Congress, if that. And when it was used in the Jimmy Stewart fashion. It was a senator or a group of senators on the floor talking to delay a bill that they opposed. So even when it was deployed, it was still only used to delay a bill, and at the end of the day, when the senators had finally tired of talking, if they hadn't persuaded people to come over to their side, that bill came up for a vote and it passed or failed on a simple majority vote. I think this is really important for your listeners to understand, which is that for the vast majority of the Senate's existence, every bill that came to the floor passed or failed on a majority vote. There was no supermajority threshold that it ever had to clear. It's only in the last few decades that the supermajority threshold began to become a regular feature of Senate business, and really only in the past decade that it has become something that basically every piece of business that comes to the Senate floor has to clear. And the irony of this is that as it became used more, it also became completely divorced from the idea of debate. So that even though pretty much every bill that comes to the floor in the Senate now faces a filibuster, you don't see senators on the floor talking and holding the floor. This is something that I get into in the book. The Senate basically backed into this this norm that we have now unintentionally, but yet we've come to accept it as completely normal.
Yeah, I think one of the most famous filibusters was the filibuster of the Civil Rights Bill in 1964, when a Southern Democratic conservative coalition held the floor for, I don't know, it was a period of weeks and months filibustering the Civil Rights Bill, and eventually that was broken and passed. But nowadays, simply saying, well, you don't have 60 votes, we're not even going to consider this. And there's no debate at all.
That's right. And, you know, a funny thing happened after the 1964 filibuster that you mentioned. A lot of people thought after that filibuster was broken that the filibuster was going to go away. You know, at this point in history, when it had been used almost exclusively against civil rights bills and almost exclusively wielded by segregationists and white supremacist senators. What happened unexpectedly was that after the filibuster was broken, it sort of became sanitized. It was almost like a generic drug entering the market. And senators began to realize that this could be a very powerful tool for whatever their pet issue was. And so they started using it, you know, little by little at first, but over the decades it became more frequently used. So now you have a situation where simply by making one phone call, any senator can increase the number of votes needed to pass a bill from a simple majority where the framers set it all the way up to 60 votes. That is effectively a filibuster. But they don't have to ever go to the floor. They don't have to explain themselves. They simply do it in a silent but deadly way, and that is what every single bill that comes to the floor in the Senate faces these days.
Is it a changeable situation?
It is absolutely changeable. The Senate is an evolving body. It has always changed its rules. The rules exist to serve the fundamental purpose of the Senate, which is to produce thoughtful policy solutions to the challenges we face. And when senators in the past have decided that the current rules do not serve that purpose anymore, they have changed them. And the way they change them is by a simple majority vote. That's the irony of this current situation, is that if you want to get rid of the supermajority requirement that bills have to secure 60 votes, you only need a majority of 50 senators to vote to do so. So it is entirely within the Senate's power to change its own rules. There is massive precedent throughout history. It has done this many times. So if the Senate decides it wants to do this, if it decides it wants to make the Senate a place that once again can pass bills and conduct the nation's business in a relatively timely fashion, it is entirely within their power to do so.
My guest today is Adam Gentleson. He's a former deputy chief of staff to former Senator Harry Reid, who was both Senate majority and minority leader during his time. He is currently the public affairs director of Democracy Forward and the author of a new book, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. It's published by Live Right. Now, President-elect Biden says he thinks he can work across the aisle in the Senate. You know, he's been a senator for a long time. He has long relationships. But what has changed since he was a senator, which I think is different than his time as vice president when he was presiding over the chamber? What has changed since he was a senator, which may preclude him being able to work across the aisle?
The main thing that's changed is the onset of partisan polarization. You know, this is the sort of the phenomenon of the big sort that we've seen in all aspects of our lives, of, you know, people deciding where to shop based on, you know, the factors that define them as individuals. So this has come to apply to the Senate. And you used to have a healthy mix of ideologies within each party. It almost sounds crazy to think about now, but as recently as the 1980s, many of the most conservative senators in the body were Democrats. And some of the most liberal were Republicans. So that used to provide fertile ground for cross-party cooperation because conservative Democrats would work with conservative Republicans and liberal Republicans would work with liberal Democrats. Ideology was much more fluid. It is only in recent decades that all conservatives have gone over to the Republican Party, and I'm speaking generally here, but we're talking rates of, you know, 80 to 90%, and almost all liberals have gone over to the Democratic Party. In the Senate, this is reflected in the fact that almost all Democrats come from blue states and almost all Republican senators come from red states. What that means is that the ability for cross-party cooperation to happen is far more difficult. And this has changed even in the years since Biden left the Senate. He left the Senate, you know, at the end of 2008 when President Obama was elected. And even in 2008, there were still a fair number of Democrats who came from red states and a fair number of Republicans who came from blue states. Today, in this 50-50 Senate, you have all of the senators sorted. You know, the big sort has come to the Senate, and the ability for cross-party cooperation is simply much, much more difficult than even it was in 2008.
And, of course, moderates are an endangered species in both parties because they always have to fear being primaried from their more liberal or conservative party members in their state.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the political reality is that, you know, politics is the business of winning elections, and that's what senators want to do. And in the vast majority of cases, it is in their political interest to stick with their party's side of the argument. It is usually not in their interest to cross over. And this gets back to the dynamic we were discussing earlier, where senators who are inclined to cross over and work with Democrats, you know, their party leadership will come to them and say, listen, if you help Democrats get a win on this bill, you're hurting the team. You're hurting Republicans' chances of taking back the majority in the midterm elections in 2022. These are conversations that leaders have with senators all the time. It happens, you know, in private, not out in public. And they even wrap it in sort of a noble policy argument. They say to the senator, look, I know you care about this policy issue, but wouldn't you be able to have more of an impact on this policy issue if Republicans took back the majority? And the way for Republicans to take back the majority is to gridlock Washington and make Democrats look like they can't get anything done. And again, this is just not my hypothesis. This is something that's been well documented for decades now by political scientists. It's an unfortunate reality of our political system, but it is a reality, and it's something that is going to make it very difficult for bipartisanship to flourish in the years to come.
You know, I was amused by something you said a little while ago about talking about the rise of partisanship to, you know, extreme examples, but I was thinking even back to former Senator David Boren. You know, 30 years ago, he left the Senate decrying this, and you've had a whole succession of people who did work across the aisles who have retired saying, this is not my institution I know anymore. But is it capable of changing back? And the reason I say that is because, as you well know, most pundits are saying that the Republican Party is going to face in the post-Trump era, you know, a sort of reckoning within itself of what the party's going to represent. And a lot of people are talking about a division within the party. Does that offer President-elect Biden opportunities to get things done that maybe didn't exist in this last session?
It could. But I think that one way to create bipartisanship is to simply have the gears turning again. I think many of the senators in the chamber don't have much experience, and this is through no fault of their own, but don't have a lot of experience crafting big bipartisan legislation because that's become so rare. And so I think it's possible that outside dynamics will force bipartisanship to happen, but I think it's not safe to bank on that occurring. I think at the end of the day, the dynamic will still prevail, that the Republicans benefit by hewing to their party line, just as Democrats do. And the way to get things done is simply to make it easier to pass legislation. And this is not radical. This is a return to the way the framers wanted the Senate to be in the first place. But once you have legislation moving, the turning of the gears, you know, the legislative process going to work is what will get senators working again. And it will create incentives for folks to work across the aisle because they see, if you're in the minority, that you can't stop the majority from going forward. So you might as well work with them. And this has been proven in history. You know, the period between the end of World War II and the 1980s and 90s were a period of pretty much unbroken Democratic control of Congress. And when Republicans were in the minority and had no hope of regaining the majority, they turned their sights to working with Democrats, and they focused on participating in the legislative process. I think that, you know, the ability to pass bills, the ability to make the trains leave the station to get things going is good for the institution and will hopefully produce some bipartisanship.
Very quickly in our last couple of minutes, how do you get the gears moving? I think that's the takeaway from the book, Kill Switch, is, you know, what needs to change in the Senate?
For me, it's about getting rid of the supermajority threshold. You know, what this does is it provides a perverse incentive. And ironically, this is something that the framers foresaw. You know, they were writing and creating the Constitution in the shadow of the Articles of Confederation. And the Articles of Confederation had been a disaster because it created a supermajority threshold for Congress to pass most important legislation. And the framers, when they wrote the Constitution, wrote extensively in defense of having every decision point in the system, in the House, in the Senate, and in elections themselves, be majority rule. And what they said was, if you create a supermajority threshold, if you make the, you know, number of votes you need to pass the legislation to be 60, you're giving the minority what they called a pertinacious minority, the ability to block anything it wants to. And that is a temptation in the world of political realism that the minority will not be able to resist. They will use that temptation to stop the majority from getting things done and to make them look bad. This was something that was clear to the framers in 1789, and it's something that continues today. So to me, the key to reform is returning the threshold for passing things in the Senate to a simple majority so that the gears can turn again. And the turning gears, I think, are your best bet for restoring the kind of bipartisanship that I think a lot of people would like to see.
So a term associated with your former boss, Senator Reid, the full nuclear option when it comes to
That's
the
right.
Senate. All right.
That's right. It's a dramatic term, and it was actually invented by Republicans
Yes.
around the time when they were contemplating it in 2005. But yes, that is what I think needs to happen.
All right. Adam Gentleson, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Adam Gentleson is a former staffer for former Senator Harry Reid and the public affairs director of Democracy Forward. He also writes a column for GQ and is the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.